You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We began last week a look at the upcoming presidential year with a new Democratic Congress, the ongoing Russia investigation, and an ongoing reboot of high-level White House staff, even cabinet officers. What are we to expect in the coming year? Tonight, we resume that discussion. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number to us in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of the San Francisco dialing area, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. With me today, we're fortunate to have with us once again, Dean Johnson. Dean is an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on television and radio of both legal and political matters, and the founder of Pundit Network. A former prosecutor, Mr. Johnson practices criminal defense and civil litigation in both state and federal courts. And if you have questions for my guest, your question need not be limited to where we might be in our discussions. Call us. Our phone number again in the studio, 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And Dean, let me welcome you back to Your Legal Rights.
Well, good evening, Jeff. And first of all, Happy New Year to you and to all of your listeners.
Thank you. And again, I'll relay that. Thank you to you. Happy New Year to you and to all of our listeners. Last week, we had so many developments, it was very hard to figure out where could we start. Amongst them, why are people in the administration racing for the sidelines? Is the ship truly sinking, or is the president simply a difficult employer with whom to work? Where's the Mueller investigation now, and where is it going? What flows from such unilateral decisions as withdrawal from Syria, or distancing ourselves from our traditional allies, or launching trade wars with partners with whom we are mutually dependent? So with that, Dean, since we left off last week, has anything changed?
Well, yeah, as Orphan Annie might say, tomorrow is a brand new day. Tomorrow, Thursday, a new Congress takes their seats officially. The House of Representatives, as we all know, is now going to be dominated by Democrats, which means that Donald Trump will find a slight shift in the balance of power in the institutions that he's dealing with. And he will be looking at what we might call the two I words, investigation and impeachment. The Congress has the power to investigate any wrongdoing or anything that it thinks might be relevant to legislation or to other types of actions. And of course, it's the Congress, the House of Representatives, that would initiate impeachment proceedings if and when they decided that that was appropriate.
So let's break that down a little bit. Let's start with the idea of investigations. What, if anything, is new on the investigative front? What should we expect?
I think we can expect that a number of committee chairs who will now be Democrats are going to be subpoenaing records, financial records, any records related to the Russia investigation, a whole panoply of things. But here's my fearless prediction for the early part of this year. I think that a major story is going to swirl around an obscure 1924 statute that's incorporated into the Internal Revenue Code called Congressional Access. The history was kind of interesting because this part of the Internal Revenue Code was enacted during a period of scandal, what we've come to call the Teapot Dome scandal. And it says this in so many words, that the chairs of three designated committees within Congress are empowered to obtain the tax returns of any American individual, and that presumably would include the person that we now know as individual number one, Donald Trump, and the person that we believe is going to be the incoming chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, which is one of those committees that can demand individual tax returns, is Richard Neal from Massachusetts. He has vowed to go after Donald Trump's tax returns. And if he gets them, which he probably will after a long fight in the courts, those tax returns then become a matter of public record.
Now, I see we have a call waiting. Johan will be with you in one moment, but I'd be remiss at this point if not first jumping to the other prong. And we'll get into this more later, but just as a general sense, is it likely we'll see the Congress taking any punitive action anytime soon?
Not anytime soon. This is a matter of very delicate political strategy. When you go down the road to impeachment, there's an old saying that if you strike at the king, you better kill him. I think the Democratic, small-d Democratic equivalent of that would be if you try to impeach the president, you'd better remove him. And the House Democratic leadership has made clear that they don't think that they see enough yet for impeachment. So everybody's going to be waiting for that big shoe to drop in the form of the Mueller report. Once that information comes forward, and it's going to be a lot of information, and I'll explain why I say that later. Once that information comes forward, then the Democratic caucus can review it and decide whether to proceed with impeachment. But it's very clear that because of the potential political backlash from attempting to impeach a president who has a very solid base, who believed that his election was a product of divine intervention rather than Russian intervention, that the caucus does not want to antagonize that base, so they will not go forward unless and until they also receive substantial Republican support. And that's only going to happen if there's something very, very serious in the Mueller report.
Johan from San Francisco, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
Hey, Johan, what's up?
Not much. How are you doing?
We're doing well. You're on the air. What would you like to know? What would you like to tell us?
In and I was wondering if your talk show discussion is limited to any topics of legal rights. I had a question about suing in small claims court, and I'm not sure what we need to do after.
You're breaking up a bit, but I think I know where you're going, and I'm more than happy to answer you. This show talks about your legal rights. Every week we have a different topic. We have different guests, and this week we're talking about the upcoming presidential year and what to expect, and anything in that realm that might talk about the ongoing investigations or the political arenas involving the president is fair game. We do have a segment every fourth Thursday of the month or last Thursday of the month called Call a Lawyer, in which case there are lawyers standing by to give you legal advice off the air. So there's always going to be somebody that touches on that topic, even when we're not talking about that on air.
Oh, fantastic. So I'll call back on a Thursday then.
The fourth Wednesday or the last Wednesday of every month. This month, it will be the 30th, which is the last Wednesday in January.
January the 30th. Fantastic.
Right, January 30th. And if there's some reason you can't wait until then, the Bar Association of San Francisco, since you're calling from San Francisco, maintains a lawyer referral and information service at 415-989-1616.
Got it.
Thank you for joining us. I hope that was of some help. And if not, our lawyers are going to be standing by on the 30th. Happy to answer your question.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. So you mentioned the House. And really not to expect a whole lot of action in a punitive front, so at least no time soon, but that some investigations are going to be underway, and they'll probably be, I imagine, a bit of a nuisance for a president who's used to running his own show and not having anybody question him. But the Senate's still Republican. Do you think anything's going to change there?
Again, we have to go back to the Mueller report. I think things are beginning to change. A lot of Trump's most vocal supporters in the Senate were taken aback by the resignation of of General Mattis by the withdrawal from Syria. A lot of them have been looking at the possibility that some of the president's economic policies make him a political liability. So I think there is a change there, but there needs to be a breaking point, a breakthrough where it becomes clear that the president has done something really, really bad, something that is truly a high crime or misdemeanor. Whether that will take the form of what's classified as a crime in the law, or the thing that seemed to be the primary concern of the framers of the Constitution, which is violating the public trust or selling the public trust to a foreign power, is has yet to be seen. But if anything like that comes out, if anything that falls under the rubric of what we've come to call collusion comes out, then I think you're going to see a change. The congressional leadership in the House of Representatives, I think, has gamed this out, and that's why Speaker Pelosi, for example, has been very careful to say that we are not really interested now in impeachment. What we're interested in is moving forward with policies and with changes that the public wants to see. And so we're not even going to talk impeachment unless it's clear that there's something there that's sufficiently serious to bring a number of Republican allies to the fold of impeachment, and then we may consider going forward. Those congressional Republicans who may shift are sort of a test in the waters to see if Republican votes could be obtained in the Senate. And, of course, to successfully remove a president from office, it would have to be what was charged in the bills of impeachment would have to be something sufficiently serious to cause as many as 20 Republicans to shift over to the Democratic side, if you will, and vote for removal from office at the end of a trial.
Now, with two calls lined up, I want to just touch on something very, very quickly so we can move on to the calls. But last week when we were here, my other guest, Jamal Anderson, opined that there is some kind of an uneasy truce or agreement between Mitch McConnell and the president, where Senator McConnell was pretty much tolerating the president's idiosyncrasies in his quest to get a conservative judges appointed and really kind of stalk the or stake the judicial branch. Do you agree with that?
I think so at this point, but even that alliance is beginning to sever. And if politicians, if nothing else, are calculating creatures. They know how to weigh their own best interest, and they know how to figure out the best way to keep themselves in power. And even with Mitch McConnell, if he is at the point where he sees that Donald Trump has become a political liability to him, that alliance is going to break. By the same token, Democrats in the House have to be very careful because they're aware that the so-called blue wave is something that may come crashing down on them. If they moved forward too rapidly with impeachment, if they fail at obtaining removal once bills of impeachment are issued, they're going to face a backlash because you have to remember the Democratic base is very energized right now. The Democratic base would very much like to see Donald Trump perp walked out of the White House after an impeachment and after a trial. But that Democratic base is not the whole of the voting public. There are people out there who literally believe that the election of Donald Trump was a product of divine intervention and who are going to support him no matter what. And those people are very much the swing votes in our polity right now. People like, for example, Connor Lamb, who is a Democrat who was elected in a district in Pennsylvania where Donald Trump won that same district by 20 points in 2016, know that the coalition that brought him to Congress is very fragile, and you can't antagonize those swing voters that could go either Republican or Democrat.
Jeff from Berkeley, thank you for your patience. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
There's one question. If it's going to be a quick answer, I've got a second one. There's been a lot of conjecture about who the corporation is owned by a government that's shrouded in secrecy that's now in front of the Supreme Court because of the Chief Justice brought it in, and it's clouded in secrecy. If you have any prognostication in that, if you're going to say, no, I don't even want to get into it, the second one is, can you open up the hearing on Kavanaugh because he wasn't forthright or honest in his answers? Could the House Judiciary Committee or whatever committee has control of the investigation situation bring Kavanaugh back in and make him answer the questions that he lied about while he was going through his rigged and very superficial investigation? Those are the questions. I'll take my question off the air.
Jeff, thank you for joining us. And do you care to break those up into...
Sure, yeah. The Mystery Corporations case, which is called In the Matter of Grand Jury Subpoena, is a fascinating case. And I think it reveals something about the Mueller investigation that I had realized but never really had a factual grasp on or any solid evidence to point to. I've said for a long time that the Mueller investigation that we're seeing right now, or have seen up to now, is merely the tip of a very, very large iceberg, and this indicates that is true. For the listeners who may not be familiar, what happened is that there was a subpoena issued to a corporation, which is simply referred to in court decisions as the corporation. The corporation said, we don't have to respond to this subpoena because we are owned by a foreign government. And there's a thing called the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act that says that foreign sovereigns are immune from subpoenas. That went to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeal. The Circuit Court of Appeal agreed with the government and said, yes, corporation, whoever you may be, you do have to, of course, you have to respond to this subpoena. It's currently in front of the Supreme Court, and the Chief Justice has put a stay on any sanctions for failing to obey the subpoena. Now, the rest is guess, speculation, anonymous sources, and so on. The running speculation right now is that the corporation is a company called the Qatari Investment Authority, which is a government-run investment corporation backed by the government of Qatar. The government of Qatar very recently purchased about a 20% stake in a large Russian oil company called Rosneft, which, of course, as everything is in the Russian economy, is run by the Russian government. And so they're claiming, among other things, that they cannot disclose what's been requested in the subpoena because it would be contrary to their own, that is to the Qatar government's laws, and that they're also owned by the sovereign government, so you can't subpoena them in the first place. I think what this tells us is that the Mueller investigation is far-reaching. It's not just a matter of a few guys in the Trump campaign or in the Trump administration talking to a few Russians about this and that. It's a long series, a network of very complex financial transactions, and the information that we're going to get in the final Mueller report is going to be enormous. It's going to be a massive report, and I think we won't see it for a while. And with that answer, Jeff, what was your second question?
Well, Jeff's no longer with us. He said he would take his answer off the air.
Okay.
But what he did say, his second question had to do with whether the new House of Representatives could compel Justice
Kavanaugh
to come back to Congress and re-answer some of those questions where he was literally either evasive or giving false information. I think as a political matter, my instinct tells me that perhaps the Democrats played that hand a little far and it might have cost them some, perhaps a Senate seat here or there. It did anger some voters and flipped a seat or two that might not have stayed. So with that in mind, do you think that they could and should compel him to come back to Congress?
I think legally they can, but I see only one route by which they could do that. A federal judge, including a justice of the Supreme Court, could potentially be impeached. And in preparation for impeachment proceedings, the House of Representatives could possibly bring him back under subpoena and question him. But I agree with you completely. One of the things that tipped the balance in the, or failed to tip the balance in the Senate was that there were a number of red state Democratic senators who were not reelected because of their vote against Kavanaugh. The blue wave would have been much deeper, or I guess a wave is actually higher than it was had that not happened. I think Democrats see that as a bringing Kavanaugh back and opening that can of worms again as a giant hot potato, and I don't think anybody's going to touch it.
I'm Jeff Hayden, and you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco, where we're looking at the upcoming presidential year with Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on both radio and television, and the founder of Pundit Network. You may call regarding any question on the topic, not limited to the exact point we may be at in the conversation. The phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, feel free to use our toll-free line. Call in our nickel at 866-798-8255. Again, 866-798-8255. And you could join us, as is David from San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi. If you can hear me, okay. I have a question about, it's an impeachment question, and then a little bit of an opinion of mine that I subject to your critique. I don't see, when I read the Charter, our Constitution, the criteria for impeaching is not that specific. If an officer is acting against the interests of our country, or if a person has made transactions that are not in our interest, that ought to be enough. And I don't know why we have to get so technical about it. Whatever Trump might have likely has done, just it's not in our country's interest to have this guy here, and that would be enough. Doesn't have to be high crimes and misdemeanors. I think you can interpret it broadly. And then my opinion is, which I submit, is that the Democrats could just state their complaint with our current president. Don't have to carry it to impeachment. They could just state their grounds for wishing to do so. And then they could leave that out in a long two-page report that everybody could read, and we could all go from there. They don't have to impeach the guy. Just state their complaint. And that's my remark. Thanks, y'all. I love your show.
Thank you, David, and thank you for joining us. And I would appreciate if you're taking our comments on the air.
Yeah. I'll listen on the radio.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah. And let me ask you, David brings up a good point. Mm-hmm. What is a high crime or misdemeanor?
Well, that's actually a very good question. And one thing that's clear is that by high crimes and misdemeanors, they don't say go look at the current edition of the penal code, and it's limited to that. The framers were concerned about much broader problems than just actual on-the-books crimes. And one thing that's an interesting exercise for David or anybody else is to go back and read what the framers actually said about the impeachment process. And one thing that surprised me when I did that was that I realized that the framers, to a person, were very uncomfortable with the concept of impeachment itself. The only role model they had for a chief executive of a government was an absolute monarch. And they were very, very uncomfortable with the notion of removing the principal executive officer of any government from office. So some of them actually said, you know, I don't think impeachment's a good idea. I mean, the guy's only, if he's bad, he's only going to be there 4 years. How bad could it get? They never met Donald Trump, but they eventually they said, yes, we should have a process of impeachment. But it's important that we not just allow impeachment because the Congress happens to disagree with the president over an issue of policy. That's going to happen all the time. And if impeachment powers are that broad, then there really is no independent executive branch. The president, in effect, becomes subservient to the Congress. And we don't want that. We want three independent branches of government to check and balance against one another. So they settled on the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors. The other thing that is clear is that beyond just what we have on the books as crimes, there is a central concern that the framers had that they considered to qualify as high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's very germane to the situation that we find ourselves in today, which is they repeatedly talked about the chief executive betraying the trust that was vested in him to a foreign power. And if we have evidence of something like that, if, say, the Russia investigation goes in that direction and there is solid evidence, and I mean rock-solid evidence, then I think you can count on an impeachment proceeding going forward.
George from San Leandro, welcome. You're on Your Legal Rights.
Well, thank you. Great. My question is to the panel, is it possible and do they think it's likely that the House could exert power to subpoena President Trump's income taxes?
Oh, yeah. As a panel of one, I think I can answer that. Yes. Any committee could issue a subpoena for Trump's income taxes. But as I mentioned at the top of the show, a subpoena is not even necessary. There's a section of the Internal Revenue Code that's referred to colloquially as the Congressional Access Provision. And it's section 6103F of the Internal Revenue Code, and it says that there are three committees in Congress and the Senate that can simply ask for any individual's tax returns, and that includes, presumably, the guy we now know as individual number one. And the one of them, at least, Richard Neal, who's expected to chair the House Ways and Means Committee, has said he is going to exercise that power. And within a very short period of time, if he has his way, individual number one's personal tax returns will become a matter of public record, and we can all read them for ourselves.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
George, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Last week, we were talking about some criminal matters and the pardon power and really whether the president can extricate himself from this mess while he's still in office. And when we resume, we're going to pick up where we left off last week. But in our discussions this morning, it seems as though we're not heading in that direction so fast. And rather than looking at some dramatic action in very short or near future, it appears that we're heading more in a direction of a longstanding investigation, which in and of itself might be the death of a thousand cuts. We'll resume momentarily. Again, I'm Jeff Hayden, and you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. We're here discussing the upcoming presidential year, investigations, the politics and legalities of the change in power, what to look forward to in the coming year, with Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on television and radio, both legal and political matters, and the founder of Pundit Network. You can call regarding any question on the topic. You don't have to pick up where we left off or where we are at that moment. The phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside San Francisco, use our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Again, 866-798-8255. This is Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Mm-hmm. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association Lawyers Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. You're listening to Your Legal Rights here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Last week, we were speaking of certain things such as pardons, and where we left off seemed a vacuum in terms of some of the recent factors that might affect both the investigation and, quite frankly, the fate of this presidency. First amongst them, the one that we're all talking about today, is the government shutdown. Now, we're roughly 2 weeks in. The highways are still open. The banks haven't closed. Why should we care?
Well, you know, one of my favorite comedic lines of all time was a great comedian, Johnny Carson, who came out in his opening monologue during a government shutdown and said, "Hey, the government shut down. Notice the difference? Most of us don't. But the fact is there are about 800,000 people out there whose ability to put food on their table and pay their rent and, you know, put their kids through college is dependent upon their government salaries. And those people are dedicated public servants. And right now they've just gone through Christmas without getting a paycheck. So it does make a difference. We haven't felt the pinch yet because those same people are being creative enough to keep their offices open sometimes on extra money that happens to be in the budget and that they've found somehow and somewhere. But we will begin to feel the pinch in terms of government services if this goes on much longer. And as government services don't work, our infrastructure begins to disintegrate and our economy begins to decline. So yes, it can affect all of us. And the most immediately affected are those people who didn't get paychecks over the Christmas holidays. But it reaches to everyone. A government shutdown is not fun. It's not a joke. It's a tragedy.
And before I ask you questions about creativity, such as sending letters to your landlord saying, "I'll mow the lawn if I don't have to pay rent," I think it's more productive I take the call from Joe in Cupertino and welcome you to Your Legal Rights.
So thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I have a question. I think what we're seeing here is it's just a symptom of the disease or the main problem. There's a lot of imbalance in our society, political, legal, so forth. And I think that imbalance is a result of a lack of representation by half of the population, which is a female gender. I think that through the last hundreds of years that this country has been a country, women have not been allowed to represent this country, not only on their behalf, but on behalf of the children and behalf of the environment, behalf of men that have less power. But there's no balance, and I think what we see here is just an imbalance. There's just not. And my question to him is, your guest there is this: is it possible that we can create some balance by maybe even mandating that at least, since half the population in this country, that they are women, to fulfill the obligation of this country by mandating that women fill the half those Senate positions as female senators, half the Congress be female, and down to the state level and local level. Until then, it's just one big dysfunctional family run by a patriarch society by elitist, wealthy white men. What is the gentleman's opinion on this? I mean, I think we see a perfect example of some balance in Sweden where women I think run that society or run a good portion of that society, and the excuse that our country is too big for that's a poor excuse.
Okay, I get the point. Let me give you my response to that. I think it's happening, and I think it's a good thing. If you look at the demographics of the current House of Representatives. If you look at the Republican side of the aisle, it's virtually all white males. I think there is one female on that side. If you look at the Democratic side, it's younger, it's more diverse, it's far more female. If you go to any local Democratic organization, your county planning committee or whatever, you will see that women are getting into politics more and more and more, and they turn out to be some of the progressive voices. As we move towards millennials becoming the generation that's in power, which just inevitably happens with the passage of time, I think you're going to see more and more women taking more and more public offices, and that's a good thing, but I don't think we have to mandate it. I think it's just going to happen.
Joe, I know we've lost the connection when your phone started to ring, but thank you for joining us. Feel free to call us back if you wish. But while you were talking to Joe, another caller called in and left a question, did not want to go on the air, but asked that we circle back, perhaps, in search of a short checklist. We have a new House of Representatives going to be seated tomorrow, and once that House is seated, what's likely to be amongst their first moves?
Well, I think their first move, there's an emerging consensus that that the Democratic caucus is going to hold off on any sort of impeachment proceedings. But that same consensus says, yeah, we know we can get Donald Trump's tax returns very easily and quickly. Let's do that as a starting point. And then they want us to remember, and they want to remember, that Donald Trump and impeachment proceedings and investigating what the Trump family has been doing for years is not the entire agenda of the United States of America. There are policy issues, the building of infrastructure, the reversal of the court decision that that found the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. All of those are policy issues that this Congress wants to deal with. And the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives, at least, is very concerned that they move forward on all of those things because, frankly, the highest disapproval rating in the country is not Donald Trump, it's Congress. And that's because they haven't done anything. They've been blockaded and stalemated for years, and the Democrats want to break that blockade. They want to break that stalemate and move forward. Now, they have time to do that and investigate Donald Trump, which is a good thing, but we have to remember something that we in media in particular often forget, which is Donald Trump is not the whole of American politics. The interests of the American people are American politics, and Donald Trump is just one person who is controlling one branch of government and doing some things that are, shall we say, unusual, if not bizarre. But that's not the whole of the American agenda.
Which seems to be a great segue into the next topics. Looking at some of the things that are changing, some of the problems that we're going through now, and what's likely to happen, what effect it might have on the presidency, what Congress might be doing about it, independent of the president, the first one that probably hits most of us is the economic decline. It's not something we hear about in the news every day, as we do about immigration and the like, but it hits our pocketbooks, and it's probably the far most important thing to most people in the country. Do you think the economy is truly in decline?
No, I don't. And I may be in the minority. A week ago, we were talking about economic decline because the stock market had taken a precipitous fall, but the stock market is slowly crawling back. I have a number of friends and colleagues who do a lot of trading. I do some trading myself. And I think what we're seeing is what we call volatility. Stock markets are going to bounce up and down, but for every downward bounce, there's going to be an upward bounce. And the real story of 2019 is that, first of all, the stock market is not the economy. The economy is strong. It's so strong and going so fast and so hot that we may have to put on the brakes at some point. We're at full employment. Our fundamentals are strong. Our manufacturing is at virtual capacity. The stock market runs now, it seems, by its own logic. The other interesting issue is that the Fed, the Federal Reserve.
Before we move into the Fed, that's a big enchilada.
Yeah, that is a huge story.
We have a couple of other issues to talk about, but before we do, I'd be remiss in not reminding you, you're listening to Jeff Hayden and Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, where we're looking at the upcoming presidential year. We're discussing this with Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on television and radio alike, both in legal and political matters. Please call about any question you have about this upcoming presidential year. You're not limited to the point we're discussing. Our phone number in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're calling from outside of San Francisco, our toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Again, that's 866-798-8255. Before we move on to the Fed, we were still talking about the economic, whether it's the decline people foresee or the lack of a decline. There was a big talk a year ago about an economic stimulus. Is that still holding?
Right now, the economy is not being stimulated in the sense of the federal government doing anything policy wise to stimulate the economy, and that is the problem. As you know, the Fed that we were mentioning a while ago controls what we call monetary policy, which can stimulate or contract the economy. It's made moves that would normally make the economy contract and slow down. The Trump administration has been spending a lot of money, which would normally be stimulating, but that seems to be it's what we sometimes refer to as a sugar high. There was a lot of money poured into the economy by the government. That took the stock market and the economy to previously unforeseen levels, but that seems to be wearing out. And we seem policy-wise to be going in the wrong direction. We need stimulus at a time when the economy may be leveling off. Other countries like China, because they have more authoritarian regimes and they're able to enforce economic policy at a very rapid pace without consulting with their constituents, is going in the direction of stimulus. I suspect Europe will in the coming year as well, because European economies are in decline for a lot of reasons. So it's a mixed bag. The economy is generally strong. It's not going to collapse anytime soon. I don't think we're going to see a recession anytime soon. But we need to fine-tune both fiscal and monetary policy in the next few months.
And we'll resume there when we come back, but we'll take this call from Martin in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Instead of waiting for to get the tax returns for the president, why can't the Congress just pass a law saying that any candidate for office needs to allow their tax returns to be seen? It won't help for this case, but just the idea that this could happen will then force the Republicans to either say yes or no, because it's a political matter.
Well, not a bad idea at all, but it seems to be pretty much redundant, since Congress itself can mandate any person, which would include any candidate for political office, to produce their tax returns. Or more accurately, they can go to the Secretary of the Treasury and say, "Dear Mr. Secretary, we want so and so's tax returns, and we want them now." And the law says that they have to produce it
for anybody. So that means a candidate for office, a candidate for office, has to release their tax returns.
Sure, it's not a bad idea. They make it a prerequisite to running for
and
a particular office.
So the House passes the bill. It goes to the Senate. That are Republicans. They're going to have to take a stand. Should a candidate release their tax returns or not.
Martin, one of the problems you're likely to run into is that the Constitution establishes what a lot of the prerequisites are for somebody running for federal office, particularly for the office of president. And to the extent you're bringing in factors that aren't outlined in the Constitution, it may well be preempted. If the Constitution were to allow it to be added as a prerequisite by Congress, the fact is it may be years before it gets through the courts and we actually have that answer from a Supreme Court that's yet to be named, at least a lot of the members.
Well, and there are a lot of statutory provisions that protect individual tax returns, but of course they can be overridden by Congress, and personally I have no problem with it. I think the public has a right to know. So I don't see constitutional issues there, but I think, as Jeff said, it takes the will of Congress, and you have, I would suspect, you have in both the Congress and the Senate a significant number of people who might not be real happy with having their tax returns being made a matter of public record for their constituencies to read. I don't think Donald Trump's necessarily alone on that.
Martin, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. I think it's a sound policy that you brought to mind. The question is whether we can, in any foreseeable future, give teeth to that policy. David from Berkeley, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thanks for having me on. Once again, first of all, a technical comment. The volume level of the audio feed when you're on hold is fading in and out and, at best, is virtually inaudible. My question has to do with the statement within the last 24 hours or so by Mitt Romney, being very critical of Trump. And I'm wondering if perhaps Romney is gearing up to maybe challenge Trump for the nomination in 2020. And I'm wondering if there's any historical precedent for a sitting first-term president to not win the nomination for a second term. And if that scenario were to play out, where might that go?
The answer to the last question is I believe no. I don't believe any sitting president has been challenged within his party.
Or I think you mean successfully challenged.
Yeah, successfully challenged within his party. And there are all sorts of reasons that have to do with the balance of power and incumbency effects and so on, why that's true.
But David, to supplement that a little bit, there have been times very recently where we've seen a person from within the Republican Party challenge a sitting president, and while they don't get the nomination, they sift off enough votes that the president loses re-election. That happened with John Anderson back in 1976, sifted off enough votes for the Democrats to win. Happened again with Ross Perot in 1992. So that part of it is a very distinct possibility. And I didn't mean to cut you off, Dean, if you have additionally want to throw in.
And there's also the precedent, again, in 1976 of new figures, new charismatic figures, attractive figures emerging within a party, challenging a sitting president, and then getting elected sometime down the road. And we remember 1976 when Gerald Ford ran and was not reelected, but there was a challenger by the name of Ronald Reagan who had some success a few years later.
So when you have a president such as this one who staked a position in the far right, even if as recently as 2 or 3 years before he ran, that wasn't the position he was occupying, it seems to me the opening that would be natural for somebody to groom themselves would be to stake out a position in the middle, which seems to be perhaps what Senator-elect Romney is doing.
Yeah, and there are a number of challengers like Sherrod Brown from Ohio who want to leverage the fact that Trump for re-election depends upon those votes out there in middle America, Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa, and so on, and who can come forward and say, look, I'm one of you. I understand your problems. I can fix your problems without all the baggage that that Donald Trump brings along, and hope to take some of those more mercurial voters who will vote for, say, a Barack Obama in one election and a Donald Trump in the next election and bring them into the fold. And as we've I've said a number of times on the show, it's not how many votes that you win, because every candidate is going to bring in a substantial number of votes. It's those swing voters in the middle who ultimately determine an election. And, of course, the guy who knows that best is the guy who actually lost an election in part because he said that in a very crude and offensive way, Mitt Romney, who said, hey, look, there's about 47% of the people that'll vote for me anyway, and 47% of the people that will vote for Barack Obama anyway. So it doesn't really matter whether we go after those. He was right as a matter of mathematics, but his sort of crude and insensitive understanding of it possibly was a factor that cost him the election.
David, thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights. Where we left off, we were just starting to talk about the Fed policy. And I guess my first question is, you've obviously heard some expressions of bad blood between the president and the chairman of the Federal Reserve. What are the president's powers with regard to the chairman of the Fed? Can and should the president remove the chair?
Can he? No. Not just because he wants to, and not just because he disagrees on a matter of policy. The chairman of the Fed can be removed on many of the same grounds that a special prosecutor can be removed. That is, for misfeasance or malfeasance in office, for being convicted of a crime, for negligence in his operation of the office, for incapacity. But just because the president or anybody else disagrees with him doesn't mean that he can be removed. The politics, the dynamics of the Fed and the president are just fascinating, because the Fed chairman, Jake Powell, is a Trump appointee. Right now, 5 out of the 7 Federal Reserve Board seats are filled, 4 of them filled by Trump appointees. And yet, the Fed is taking a policy direction that is directly opposite to that the White House would prefer. The Fed is tightening the money supply by selling off large amounts, billions of dollars in securities, and taking the money and putting it back in its treasury, also raising interest rates slightly, all of which serve as sort of a brake on the economy. Donald Trump, being a good real estate developer from New York, thinks that raising interest rates is per se bad. Low interest rates are great for the economy, and doesn't understand why this is happening.
Do you think he truly understands what the Fed does?
No, I don't think he does. I think he believes he's what old-fashioned economists might call a mercantilist. He believes that whatever you can, the more you can sell, the better it is, and the lower interest rates you can charge, the better it is for manufacturers and vendors and developers, which is what he is. The Fed operates by some very sophisticated economic criteria. They look at leading indicators to figure out where the economy may be going in the future. They try to anticipate that, and they try to adjust interest rates to fine-tune the movement of the economy. All that being said, I think the most recent decision to tighten the screws on the economy by the Fed was probably a mistake. There seems to be a disconnect between the Fed and where the economy is going right now. Even though I disagree with what the Fed has done, I will defend to the death their right to remain independent and their right to do that, because something that important should not be left to the short-term interests of any particular politician, whether it be the president or anyone else.
Although the other side is that, to the extent that we've had almost zero interest rates now for several years, no money is making it into the banking sector. And if the money doesn't make it into the banking sector, there's few places for investors to put their money other than the stock market or real estate, which means that some of that money that would have gone into the banks, come out of the banks, gone into loans, gone into building more capital, doing some other expansive things, wasn't taking place in the usual format, because the interest rates are so low that the banks couldn't get money, much less use the money.
Yeah, you're quite right. And that's what we call the no better place argument. There's no better place to put your money than in the stock market, because the stock market's earnings are really outstripping interest rates. And there are some arguments for quantitative tightening, which is what the Fed is doing right now by raising interest rates. Corporate debt is probably somewhat overextended. But all of those things taken into consideration, it's probably not the time for quantitative tightening and raising interest rates just yet. We're about to, I think, experience some decline because, quite frankly, the whole world is in decline, and we're going to need that stimulus down the road in a few months.
And the reality is the rest of the world is starting to slow down. Europe, several of our trading partners are becoming somewhat politically unstable, and the debt worldwide is somewhere between 350 and 400% of the gross domestic product worldwide. So we're likely to feel somewhat of an owie. Exactly what that means?
Yeah, we will. Everybody talks about globalization. At bottom line, globalization means that we're all interconnected, and what affects Europe and Japan and China and India today will affect us tomorrow. We've been somewhat insulated from those effects, partially because of the tax cut, partially because we've maintained low interest rates, and partially because our economy is still quite vigorous and innovative in selling the products that the world wants. But eventually, we're going to feel the same effects that we're seeing around the globe now. That wall is going to come tumbling down, and we've got to be prepared to deal with it. And I think we're just going in the wrong direction right now.
That much being said, that'll probably be the last note. We have about 4 minutes left in the hour, not quite, and I'd like to give you a couple minutes to sum up any last thoughts. There's a lot that we've talked about that we didn't have time to bring up on the air. Feel free to take about 2 minutes.
Well, I think it's important to watch the news with a little bit of an objective eye in the coming months. What we're going to see is a game of three-dimensional chess. Nancy Pelosi, the Congressional Democratic delegation, the Congressional Republican delegation, the Senate are all jockeying for position. And we're going to see a flood of information probably in the next several months, especially when the Mueller investigation comes down. Right now, Bob Mueller has done what a good prosecutor has done. He's kept his investigation secret. Eventually, all of that's going to come out, and we're going to see the rest of the tip of that iceberg. At that point, all bets are off, and I'll come back on the show having read all of that information, and we'll talk about where we go from there, whether Donald Trump is going to run out his second term or whether he may be facing serious bills of impeachment.
Or whether the Democrats do what the Republicans did for the 3 years leading into the last election, which is to so weaken the lead candidate as to make her virtually unelectable. Do you think that might be what the Democrats do?
I think they might try, but that's going to be a tough road to hoe, because getting anything policy-wise through this Congress and enacted into law, something that the Democrats could run on, is going to be difficult. Donald Trump, as I said, has a core of supporters who right now in this very, very divided political atmosphere can be the swing votes. And unless and until you can pull those swing votes away, Donald Trump is going to be a very, very formidable foe.
You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW-FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We've been discussing part two of our series on the upcoming presidential year. My guest tonight has been Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst and Redwood City attorney Dean Johnson, the founder of Pundit Network. Thank you for joining us, Dean.
My pleasure as always, Jeff.
We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights, where in conjunction with the Labor and Employment section of the California Lawyers Association, we'll feature a program devoted to the nuts and bolts of labor law. Joining me for Labor Law 101, attorney Thomas Lenz of Pasadena, California, and from the National Labor Relations Board, Jill Kaufman. Thank you for listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. And at the controls for the vocationing, Joanne Marr, Debbie Kennedy. Answering your calls, my friend Martin McLean. I'm Jeff Hayden. Thank you again for listening, and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.